the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
My first guest is from a family steeped in drawing, books and art. Her French-born father, Tommy Ungerer, was a famous illustrator whose childhood in the shadow of the Nazis informed his work. He published 140 books and created thousands of sketches and drawings. As a child, her family moved to Mizzen Head in West Cork, and it was there that she began to follow in her father's footsteps. Aria Ungerer of Pictor Productions, your creative producer of animation flicks and curator of the Tommy Ungerer estate. You're very welcome to the programme. That childhood growing up in Mizzen Head, as part of a family that had moved to the area, what was that like?
Well, my parents moved to Ireland in the mid-70s when my mother was pregnant with me. So I'm actually born in Bantry Hospital, and I grew up on the very edge of the Mizzen Head Peninsula on a farm. And my parents had come across this property while they were looking for a place to live in Ireland potentially, and just completely fallen in love with it. So it's on the edge of the cliffs. It's just mostly open countryside all around. And yeah, I went to a little tiny school, local school, with two rooms, four classes in each room, four people in my class in school. And my younger brothers and I would have been the only, as we're colloquially called, blow-ins in our neighbourhood or in our class or in our school.
Within 20 square miles.
Yeah. We were even farther out than where most of the blow-ins in West Cork would be, you know, like around Ballydehob and Bantry and so on.
So then the identity for you, you were obviously completely steeped. You'd been born there, you went to the local school, but then your parents, your mom was American, your dad French. Did you have that sense of a more nuanced identity?
Absolutely.
Did your dad speak French to you, for example, at home?
Yeah, I mean, we spoke different languages at home, French and German, to some degree. We ate different kinds of food. We pronounced words differently, thanks to my mom. I suppose it's that very typical first generation child thing where you sort of are undercover all the time, and so you become a good observer of people. And I think on the plus side, it's great, you have this amazing freedom. You can kind of be a little bit like water, learn to fit in anywhere, and at the same time you're never really completely of a place.
It's like you're on the inside, but yeah, you have a bit of a perspective from the outside at the same time.
So I used to do things like, I remember we didn't have a television until I was about 8 years old, so every morning in school, all the kids would gather and they'd talk about what had been on TV the night before. So I got really good at like pretending that I knew, you know, and even like sometimes making up little storylines that they were like, wait, what?
And tell us about your dad. His own family background is an amazing story. He was originally from the Alsace region in France, and his own family were interesting as well. They were in the watchmaking.
Yeah. So my father's paternal family, the Ungerers, were a family of astronomical clockmakers. And actually, the cathedral in Strasbourg, there's this enormous astrological clock, and that is made by the Ungerer clockmaking factory. So my paternal grandfather, Tommy's father, ran that clock factory, that astronomical clock factory. Yeah.
But he died quite young, didn't he?
He did. When my father was three, my grandfather got stung by a hornet and developed septicemia and died very soon afterwards.
So it wasn't necessarily a sort of a financially privileged background, really, that your father grew up in.
No, but the vestiges were certainly there, you know, and his sisters and older brother would have grown up in a very bourgeois kind of way. And there, as far as I can tell, there was certainly plenty of money. But then after my grandfather died, that all fell asunder. And my father was younger than his siblings by 10 years. So his mother took him and I guess the two sisters and moved back to this industrial suburb where she had grown up, in the house of her mother, who was very unhappy to have them there. But the good thing was that they had like a huge garden, so they were able to, you know, grow vegetables and things like that.
And then when your dad was still quite young, Second World War broke out, yes, the Nazis invaded the Alsace region and then obviously on towards the rest of France as well. What was that like for him?
It's interesting because sometimes when he would describe it, it was almost like it was this amazing, exciting adventure, you know, and then other times you could just see how traumatic the whole thing was, because obviously they were in fear for their lives every day. And in the lead up to the German annexation as well, I think there was a lot of fear about being evacuated. Nobody really knew what was going to happen. Obviously, you know, Alsace has notoriously changed hands between the French and the Germans many times. My great grandmother changed nationality, or was forced to change, I think, 4 or 5 times, something like that.
And your dad would have found himself in that situation, albeit as a kid, because quite quickly the Nazis would have changed the schooling, introduced more German. What did he tell you much about what that
was
like?
Yeah, and I mean, in fact, he's written a whole memoir about that. But so from one day to the next, French was forbidden. Everyone had like a month or so to learn German, and that was it. You could be arrested if you were found speaking French or listening to French on the radio, anything like that. And one of the very first things that the Nazi regime did was they came and took over the school system and installed a German Nazi educational system, which was really about brainwashing the children. Every hour they had to do Hitler salutes and sing Hitler songs. All the children were forced to join Hitler Youth. You know, all the homework was around, you know, the iconography and the mythology of the Nazis. So, and also the children were really encouraged to report their parents. They were given a lot of financial incentives, and they were told they'd go off to this like amazing boarding school if they. Tommy didn't know anyone who had ever done that, but they.
And your dad, from an early age, he was interested in drawing and drawing cartoons and various things like that. Sometimes in a slightly rebellious way, but the teacher would have engaged with him on that and told him one day to draw a Jew.
I mean, don't forget that Hitler was an artist. So what the teacher would say to Tommy is, you know, don't worry, the Führer needs artists. You know, even if you're maybe not the best in some of the other things in school, don't worry, you have this drawing talent and we could make use of that.
And told him to draw a Jew one day?
So Tommy tells the story of one of the very first pieces of homework that they were given was to draw a Jew. And he didn't know what that was. In the neighborhood that they lived in, there wasn't a big Jewish population, although in Alsace and in Strasbourg there was an enormous Jewish population before the war. So he went home to his mother and he asked her, what's a Jew, you know? And so she started giving him some of these descriptions, which are very sort of stereotypical, unfortunately. Like a Jew, I have the picture here in front of me, you know, a Jew has dark hair, they wear glasses, they smoke. Somebody obviously told him they have big lips. And so that was one of the very first homeworks that they had to do.
Which is extraordinary, that level of reinforcement of stereotypes through the education system. Yeah. And for your dad then, there was a bit of a rebellious streak as well, because his mother wasn't particularly into any of this. No. And the things he would have drawn at home were quite different.
Absolutely. And she kept everything. She kept all the diaries, all the childhood drawings. Like there are drawings in here that he made as a child, you know, making fun of Hitler, with like Hitler having like a beer stein hidden behind the podium where he's giving a speech and he looks really like disheveled, or, you know, satirical drawings of the soldiers pillaging, you know, because that's one of the things they used to do, is go around to people's homes and take all the jam out of their stores and the cellar and things like that. So, I mean, they could have gotten in a lot of trouble for those.
For having even those drawings. And afterwards he left and he went to the United States. But things changed after the war, because even people from the Alsace region were kind of viewed differently by the rest of France.
So when they were so excited when the French finally came back. I mean, it was this moment that they had waited for so long, you know, so much anticipation. And things were very difficult then under the French also. For example, the Alsatian accent was considered German, and the kids were called Salbusch, dirty Germans. Tommy was very traumatized by this one experience with one of his teachers, who told him, you know, lose your German accent before you get interested in French literature. And he loved to read. He also was shocked that when the Germans came, they burned all the French books. And then when the French came back, they burned all the German books. And he found that very traumatic. And I think it really gave him the sense of the absurdity of ideology and the absurdity of the world of adults.
And that was something that he retained through his work and his later life. Correct. And he went to the US and he went to, was it Manhattan he was
yes.
in?
Yes, yeah. He moved to New York in 1956 he used to always tell the story. He said, I moved to New York with $50 in my pocket and a trunk full of drawings. But he did have a fiance who became his wife, and that's how he got the green card to stay there. They had met in Europe, and she was American. Her father had been the sheriff of Amarillo, Texas, but she lived in New York. And he just hit the ground running. He was, I guess, very charming, you know, and it was a time where there was, you could actually go and meet with an art director. So he became very successful
very
quickly.
It was literally about knocking on doors.
Literally, you could knock, you could get a phone book, find the phone number, make a call, go in, show your work.
And the woman he met there, that was his first wife. And he married three times in all. So your mum would have been his third wife.
Third and
right?
final wife, yeah.
Yeah, and his career took off because, just to put it in perspective, I mean, he would have done cartoons and posters and animated work for the New York Times. He did the movie poster for Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. But then he also became very interested in children's books and animated books.
Yeah, and very, I mean, if you were working in illustration in those days, working in children's books was one of the big things that you would try and get into. And actually what happened is Tommy went to see Ursula Nordstrom, who is the very famous editor of children's literature at Harper's. And he was very unwell, actually, but he came and he showed her this manuscript that he had for a story about a family of pigs. And she said, look, it's too violent. I think the butcher killed the pigs at the end. So she said, look, it's too violent. I can't publish it like this, but I like the pigs and I like you. And
was that an element of a cultural thing as well? That, you know, the idea that in America, they don't like things that don't have a happy ending. Whereas perhaps from a European perspective, and you see this in film, you see it in lots of places, there doesn't have to be a happy ending.
Yeah. Maybe. And maybe it is just categorically that, like, if you present a story to children where all the characters that they grow to love through the story get killed at the end, it might be just a little step
and a sort
too
of a
far.
Bloodied cleaver,
yeah,
and a butcher.
Yeah, I'm sure there was blood in there. Yeah, it might
have been a bit much. But do you think, though, and this runs through his work, that sense of mischief and of humour, but with a bit of an edge to it?
Always an edge.
Do you think that came perhaps from that childhood experience?
I mean, Tommy loved to provoke a reaction out of people, I have to say. So be that through his work or things that he said, you know, he really loved to get a reaction out of people. But he had grown up in essentially a war zone. He had seen killing. He had been shot at. He knew what it was to see somebody's head blown off. So it's some of the things that maybe to us here nowadays are kind of abstract or conceptual. We see them on a screen happening somewhere else to other people. Those were realities of his childhood and his growing up.
Well, he obviously got a feel for the happy ending with the children's books and the pigs, because all of that took off and he was hugely successful at it. But he also started doing a bit of Nixer work outside of that with adult books and drawing erotica for adult books. And that kind of backfired.
Yeah, so Tommy lived in New York for 15, 16 years, and he was very successful in illustration and in children's books. He did a lot of advertising, reportage. He also did a lot of political work against the Vietnam War, which he did get in a little bit of trouble for also. And, you know, Tommy was never constrained by any sort of, I don't know, his imagination was very free ranging, and he also did a lot of social satire, and he got involved in making books of erotica. And in those days, you could have like these different lives, and they wouldn't necessarily be found out. I guess lots of people had double, triple existences. That's it. And at some point, the children's literary world found out that he had made this book called Fornicon, which is actually a satire on the mechanization of sex, which I guess was this very big theme in the 1960s as well. And they freaked out, and then he freaked out in response to that. And what happened then was his books were taken out of all the libraries, all the public libraries. And in America, like as in children's books, the libraries are one of your biggest markets. So if you lose that, you're in trouble. And we still find books that have like the stamp in them that says rejected. So that really blew up in his face at that point.
And that would have been heralded a big change in terms of the direction and shape of his career. And he moved, I think it was originally to Nova Scotia and then Mizenhead
and
to Ireland.
And he completely stopped making children's books until 1996, yeah.
For you and your own memories of your dad and him working in his studio at home in Cork, what was that like? What was the studio like?
I mean, the studio is just this magical place to me. I remember as a child, I used to go in there and I'd sit at one table and Tommy would be working at his desk and I'd be working on my projects. And he'd be so one pointed in his work. You know, every now and again, you'd hear him swear or scream if he got a line wrong. But the studio itself is just full of all this crazy stuff, you know, like there's a human sized skeleton when you walk in. There are shelves and cabinets full of all kinds of things that he's collected over the years, you know, old magazines, books, Barbie legs, doilies, things, implements from the farm, broken glass, like everything you could
think
of. Very
eclectic mix.
Yeah.
And your mom, who was also a visual artist, she took up a bit of sheep farming.
So my mom was not an artist.
Well, she wasn't?
No, but she... So they bought this amazing land at the edge of Mizzen and it made sense to graze it. And so they started by having a few sheep and then that really snowballed. She decided to start a proper sheep farm. She ended up with, I think they had like 800, 1,000 sheep. And
probably
yeah.
not a lot of women sheep farmers down in West
I
Park
don't
at that time.
Ever remember meeting one. I used to go with her sometimes to the marts around the country. And I always remember like I'd walk in at my mother, who was very striking looking woman as well. And you just kind of hear like not quite a hush, but like the whispers, you know. And I always remember it was like all men, you know, and you'd hear them talking about, oh, herself this and herself that. And I don't know if that was my mother specifically they were referring to, but she really stood out. But she brought a lot of breeds of sheep to Ireland that were not being bred here. And we all were involved in the sheep farm to some degree. I mean, I have delivered lambs, for example.
So you know your way around a sheep farm, literally.
Yes.
And your dad lived to a very big age, 2019, he died.
Yeah.
And you now live in East Cork rather than over where you had grown up in West Cork. But he was at your home when he died.
He was at our home when he died. I mean, he was actually staying in the Airbnb at the bottom of our driveway because we had some construction work going on and it made him too nervous. I mean, he had just been in the hospital actually earlier that week because he had some headaches. And so I took him to get checked out. You know, he spent the whole day in the matter private. He was delighted. He was so he loved it in there. He was getting tested for everything. He got the all clear and he left and he was beside himself. He said, "This is great. It's all in my mind. I'm totally fine." And so then he had, you know, he was in the best form ever for the last couple of days. And I went down to bring him his crossword on the Saturday morning and check on him. And he had a smile on his face. He was writing something. He had just gone off.
Very difficult, I'm sure. Very sad. I'm sure you miss him.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a very strange thing because I still work with him, essentially. You know, I worked with him for a decade before he died and I'm the work I do now is a continuation of that. But it's weird because it's you're also trying to grieve your parent. And at the same time, you have to keep the show on the road or I had to keep, you know, we had exhibitions opening, all kinds of things. So they're.
And your own animation work, Aria, the animated series Flicks, which you have been involved in, and there's a new series of that as well.
Yes. So Flicks is a book that Tommy wrote for kids in 1996 after a 25-year hiatus from making children's books. He decided he was going to start again and that each book would have a very clear social message for kids. So the story of Flicks is about two cats, married couple, I guess, married, and they go to the hospital. She's pregnant and in labor and out pops a puppy, a pug. So it's about being the only dog growing up in this family of cats and in this world of cats. So the book, you know, tells the whole story of Flix's life, but the TV show, the animated adaptation that we've made, really focuses on Flix at around the age of 7. And so that's a concept that Tommy and I worked on and developed together.
And it's interesting, there's that sort of theme of difference and of insider, outsider and dealing and managing with difference, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's all about, Flix is all about celebrating difference. It's all about not fitting in, and that can be your superpower. You don't have to be like everybody else. You don't have to look like everybody else or sound like everyone else. In the book, you know, he describes that Flix speaks cat with a dog accent and he speaks dog with a cat accent, which was very, we had a lot of debates about how we would replicate that in human
I'd say language. I see a lot of crack coming up with that, actually, and how it would work. And that thing of some difference being your superpower, he was never diagnosed, but you suspected that your dad was actually dyslexic, which is a phrase about superpower that I've spoken to people with dyslexia who say that it can be that.
I mean, he self-diagnosed himself because he had that classic thing where he would read a word and he'd see a different word. But then for him, that was brilliant because he would take that as a starting point to create a whole different perception of something or create a whole new word that maybe doesn't exist yet. And don't forget, he didn't speak any language perfectly. Tommy spoke French, German and English, but he didn't speak any of them perfectly.
What do you think he'd make of the world today? Where we're at now,
he would be completely unsurprised. In fact, as things are playing out right now in many spheres, it's exactly as he predicted all along. First of all, he was very prepared at any moment for a pandemic. So when COVID hit, it was like I already had everything stored in my pantry, you know, because that's how we were brought up. Also in the 80s, there was a lot of fear about nuclear fallout. And so a lot of people in West Cork who had moved to West Cork were there partly for that reason, because they thought Ireland would be the least hit. And so we had that mentality anyway, that kind of bunker mentality, which also came from Tommy's war experience.
But also perhaps maybe he was unshockable in that way.
Also, you know, when he moved to the US, he was really shocked to find so much racism there. He couldn't believe it. One of the reasons he moved there was because he loved jazz music and he wanted to go and meet some of his heroes. And he could not believe the way that Black Americans were treated. And then going to Texas and where there was segregation. So he always said to me or to us, you know, don't be fooled by the veneer of America. Underneath, it's so racist. Maybe people don't say it out loud, but it's there.
And he had a number of mottos.
Yeah. So one of his mottos was expect the unexpected, and that's made it into the English language because he made it a part of a big advertising campaign for the New York Times. And then the other one was don't hope, cope, which is, you know, don't just wish and hope for something to happen, make it happen, make the change.
Which sounds like very good advice in all places and at all times. Aria Ungerer of Picture Productions, creative producer of animated series Flix and also curator of the Tommy Ungerer Estate. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning.